this morning is In Re McDowell Revocable Trust. I should note, Justice Miller Lerman is recused in this matter. Mr. Lingelbach?
Yes, mm-hmm. This is James Hall. I represent the Rogers Stockwell Trustee and the process as well. I did understand that there was a ruling on my motion as well. I did try to negotiate time with either side of the parties. I am an appellee. I burst it in. Neither party is willing to give to me any of their 10 minutes. I would ask if the court would reconsider and set aside some separate amount of time, if not the 7 minutes I asked.
I think our ruling is that if you could come to no agreement, then you will each get equal time.
Who's we, the appellees?
Yes.
Okay.
If you're one of the appellees, then you will get...
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, you're right.
You may approach and you may proceed. Mr. Lingelbach, good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is John Lingelbach and I represent the appellant in this matter, Sandra Stockall. This is a dispute between Sandra and her adult sister, Jane Horning. They are the sole survivors of Robert McDowell and Sandra McDowell, who are both deceased. The issue in this case is whether their mother, Betty McDowell, properly exercised a power of appointment that Betty had been given by Robert in his trust.
Counsel, do you agree that it is appropriate to characterize that power of appointment as a limited power of appointment?
I do, or a non-general, as it's sometimes called.
Thank you.
We believe that it was properly exercised and that the decision of the trial court should be reversed. Just by way of background, Robert and Betty McDowell each owned 270 shares in a ranch corporation in central Nebraska known as the McDowell Cattle Company. They both drafted their trusts and wills in 2001, and they have mirror language. The language that's important in Robert's trust and that is at issue basically gave Betty the right to choose which of their issue, and it could be one or more, would receive the assets of what are called Trust A. And the principal assets were Robert's half of the McDowell Cattle Company, his 270 shares. There were other assets as well, but this fights generally over the 270 shares. The language says, upon the death of my wife, in the event my wife shall survive me, the then principal of Trust A, and that's a capitalized term, shall be distributed to or held in trust for the benefit of such one or more of my issue in such shares and proportions as my wife shall appoint by will. What's important is that when Robert referred to his Trust A assets, that was a capitalized term. He was talking about a specific trust. But when he told Betty that she can either distribute those assets to any one of the issue or hold them in trust, that is not a capitalized term.
Didn't it say hold in trust for the benefit of, and then there are three categories?
Yeah, and I skipped the other two categories and paraphrased because those aren't really an issue. Betty didn't choose the spouse of any issue. She didn't choose a tax-exempt charitable organization. She only chose, as we'll see in a moment, she only chose Jane.
Isn't the issue
Betty.
Here that Betty appointed the Trust A assets to her own trust and then directed that they be merged with the property in her trust and administered by the trustee?
Yes, the appellee argued at trial that the power of appointment fails because these assets took a very brief trip through Betty's trust. And in my view, and in the plain language of the power of appointment, that was permitted. She was allowed to hold them in trust with no designation of what trust they had to be held in. For the benefit of any issue.
Were they held in her trust for the benefit, or were they to be merged with her property and administered by her trustee as part of the property of her trust?
Well, they were put in the trust so that she could distribute it to one or more of the issue. I think that's the clear intent. If you look at her will and her trust, she distributes those shares to her daughter, Sandra, and that was entirely permitted by the power of appointment. That's the specific language of the power of appointment permitted that. So she did hold it in trust for the benefit of one or more of the issue of Robert. That was Sandra.
Is this your substantial compliance argument?
Well, not only that, but it's also, I think, the plain language of the power of appointment. I don't think we need to get to substantial compliance. But secondly, and I've also cited in our brief the restatement's approach of selective allocation, and there is a comment, I think it's section 22.2 under the restatement of property, that says where someone who holds a power of appointment puts their assets in there and puts the appointed assets in there, there's a selective allocation that's made, and those assets that are Betty's are used as she directs, and those assets that are subject to the power of appointment are allocated as Robert intended. And that's exactly what happened.
What of the argument that the assets from deceased husband's trust were available to the creditors of wife and whoever else might have claims on her estate?
Well, a couple of things. I know that argument was made. First of all, that seems to me to be a red herring. Betty had $1.3 million in assets in her own name, and she had $11,000 in debts. And those debts were paid not using any of Robert's assets.
But, counsel, you're looking at that at the after the death. Shouldn't we be looking at it at the time of the transfer?
Well, I don't think so. I think you have to look at whether it was truly exposed to any creditor's claims. There were no creditors.
Again, that's after the fact, but at the time of the transfer, that's where you look at whether it's held in trust. I mean, under your argument, then, it could have went to a non-trust and then later went to a trust, and under your theory, that would be okay then, correct?
Well, no, because the language of the power of appointment says it has to be held in trust. It doesn't specify what trust. So
we would look at the trust at the time of the transfer, correct?
Well, I suppose you do, but I think the approach of the restatement is that property, even though it's placed in Betty's trust, is not her property. That's section 22.1, which holds property subject to a non-general power of appointment, that's what we have, is exempt from the donee's, that's Betty, creditors, and from liability for expenses of administering the donee's estate. So the restatement of property already addresses that when there's a merger or there is a placing of assets in a trust that includes both the donee's assets and the appointed assets.
So when was the time of the transfer, to use Judge Couch's language, for purposes of the exercise of the limited power of appointment?
When did the transfer occur?
Yes, when did the transfer occur?
I suppose the transfer occurred when the action was taken to take those shares out of the name of Robert's trust and placing them in Betty's trust, which was a transaction that was done by an attorney by the name of Larry Todd, who handled the administration of the state. So when the shares moved from Robert's trust to Betty's trust is probably when that transfer was effected.
Wouldn't it have? I mean, this was a testamentary exercise of the power of appointment, wasn't it?
It was in her will, Betty's will.
So wouldn't it speak as of the date of death?
I suppose you could view it that the transfer in the eyes of the law occurred upon her death, but the perfunctory action of moving the shares via certificate happened when Mr. Todd...
But that's just ministerial, isn't it?
It could be. It could be.
So what difference... let's assume date of death is the date of transfer. What does that do to the rights of creditors argument that's used?
Well, I don't think it gives them a right to these shares of stock. First of all, these shares of stock were always separately, Robert's shares were always separately identified by a certificate. When they left his trust and were put into Betty's trust, there was a separate certificate. And when those certificates left, we can identify the specific shares that came out of Betty's trust that were Robert's and Betty's. So there was always a tracing. And if you apply the restatement's approach that her creditors have no claim to the appointive assets. That's the rule in the restatement, section 22.4. They would have no.
What case law do we have in Nebraska in terms of the trust principles that underlie the restatement approach?
Not much.
We've never adopted selective allocation, have we?
Not that I know of. There are portions of the restatement of property that have been adopted by this court. I don't think this court has had the opportunity to address that particular section 22.1.
What's the best argument that it should be adopted?
Well, it seems to me that you want to interpret a trust in the way in which the donor's intent is best carried out. And that's the cardinal rule for interpreting a trust, is figure out what did Robert intend and figure out next, did that happen? And what he wanted was his issue to get his trustee assets, as Betty decides. Did that happen? Yes, those 270 shares, while they took a trip through Betty's trust, ended up in the hands of one or more of his issue, as Betty determined. So, to me, the cardinal rule being determine his intent. His intent was carried out, and I think that's an argument as to why the court ought to apply 22.1, the restatement of property, to carry out his intent. Otherwise, his intent is going to fail, not because of anything that, in particular that anybody did, but because it made a very short trip through Betty's trust.
Wasn't the donor's also intent that if the appointment wasn't effectively made, then the trust A assets would be distributed according to the residual clause?
May I finish? I'm on.
Yes.
You may.
That is true. There is a residual clause at the end of that, after the power of appointment, that determines where the assets would be. There's no other questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry, ma'am. You are Ms.
Horning Shear.
Ms. Horning Shear. Could you spell your name for us, please?
H-O-R-N-U-N-G hyphen S-C-H-E-R-R.
Thank you very much. Now, how much time do you think you have?
Your Honor, I think I have 10 minutes of time.
You only have only have 10 minutes for appellees, and you've got two appellees, so I think you've got 5 minutes of time.
So he's cross-appellant, he's adverse. So you're
the way we structure things,
I will speak efficiently.
Okay.
Chief Justice and Justices of the Nebraska Supreme Court, you've heard the issue before you of whether a limited power of appointment can be exercised in favor of the Donee's Revocable Trust. In making its determination, the appellant is asking the court to disregard long-standing Nebraska estate planning principles, disregard significant and recent precedent from other jurisdictions, and disregard factual findings of the trial court. We urge the court to find the exercise impermissible and affirm the trial court's order because of the important precedent it sets for Nebraska. To summarize appellant's argument, we are starting with a black and white document. Practitioners, estate planning parties in the state of Nebraska, you can look within those four corners. You know the donor's intent. Then appellant is asking you to disregard the donor's intent. Disregard the black and white document.
What was the donor's intent?
The donor's intent was driven by tax planning.
Well, I don't care what it was driven by. What was his intent?
His intent, based upon the four corners of the document, was that his assets could not be used for the benefit of Betty, her estate, her creditors, or the creditors of her estate. His intent was that if the power was ineffectively exercised, the assets would pass pursuant to the residuary clause. Appellant is also...
Counsel, opposing counsel believes that creditors could not reach this property because of the nature of her assets and liabilities. What's your response to that?
Under 30-38-50, that addresses the ability of creditors to reach the assets of a revocable trust. Now, this court has not determined whether that means assets only as of the date of death or prior to the date of death. The Kansas Appellate Court in Bolander recently found that an IRA that came part of the trust at the date of death was subject to claims of creditors. And more importantly, Robert's assets were used to pay Betty's taxes and creditors, the exact thing Robert said could not happen. So we are also disregarding the fiduciary's duty to follow the express instructions. We are going to reform an unambiguous will. We're going to apply a rule of construction when there's no ambiguity. We're going to disregard the factual findings of the trial court that the assets were merged. Robert's assets were used to pay Betty's taxes and creditors. And Robert's assets were not segregated.
You just made a comment. Is there a factual record that they actually were used to pay creditors and
there
taxes?
There is, very much. The attorney that administered this estate noted that in the process of administering the estate, the merged assets, Robert's assets, were used to pay Betty's taxes and creditors. The trustee of Betty's trust also admitted that the merged assets that included Robert's assets were used to pay Betty's tax and creditors. That is supported by the record. Then appellate is asking you to look past the fact that the Uniform Powers of Appointment Act has not been adopted in Nebraska.
In the absence of the proper exercise of this power by Betty or her estate, where would the settlers' assets have gone?
Robert provides specifically that they pass pursuant to the residuary clause that gives 50% to appellant and 50% to appellee. That is specifically provided, and that is what his intent was.
At the time that you filed your request for instructions to the trustee, had the transfers already occurred?
We don't believe so. The petitions and answers filed by appellant and cross-appellant ask for specific instructions on what to do with assets that had been transferred and what to do with assets that remain to be transferred.
Which assets remained to be transferred at the point when the pleadings were filed?
The stock powers had been transferred. The real estate had been transferred. We don't know what the remaining assets that they refer to that had not been transferred. Their pleadings say assets had not been transferred. In their reply brief, they note that assets had been transferred, but they refer to specific assets. There's no statement of what remaining assets are. We don't know that. There's nothing in the record to say what the remaining assets are that haven't been transferred. Clearly it says that the stock had been transferred and the real estate had been transferred. But it also says we want instructions on how to transfer the remaining assets.
Counsel, why was the power of appointment ineffective?
It was ineffective because it violated Robert's intent. Nebraska law provides that the intent of the donor controls. It provides that unambiguous wills are not open to construction. No one testified that there was an ambiguity or mistake. That was not set forth in the pleadings. And a will speaks conclusively at the date of death. These are three cardinal principles of Nebraska law. And if you look at BMO, Buck, Reisman, the California appellate decision from 3 weeks ago, all of them impermissible under the same principles that Nebraska has here.
Why don't you give us the cite to the California appellate opinion from 3 weeks ago, unless it has previously been provided?
No, it hasn't. It has been filed but not published. It's called Haley versus Brosman, B-R-O-Z-M-A-N, decided December 8th, 2016, opinion filed but not published. Here it says 2016 California Reporter, unpublished. So you may all know that this limited power of appointment, it is often used. It is referred to as one of the most efficient estate planning vehicles. This could be one of the most unpredictable estate planning vehicles. This is not an exercise for the court or the law of limited powers of appointment. We ask you to carefully consider important Nebraska precedent and affirm the trial court's order. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Skolka, good morning to you, and you will have 5 minutes.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. I represent appellee and cross-appellant Roger Stockall as trustee of the Robert McDowell Revocable Trust. I will use my time to address Mr. Stockall's cross-appeal, which is relevant if this court does not grant Sandra Stockall's relief. We requested a trial, and the county court found that Roger Stockall acted, quote, appropriately, reasonably, and in good faith under the circumstances, and he did not commit a breach of trust in executing his duties as the trustee of Robert's Trust, end quote. No party has assigned that ruling an error. It is final. There was further no finding that Roger committed any act as trustee of Robert's Trust constitutes the scale of willful default, willful misconduct that's cited in Robert's Trust exculpatory clause. Yet the county court ordered Roger to recover all assets, income, and principal attributable to the trust. This is an error, as it is both inconsistent with the good faith finding. County court was without authority to do so, and this court should reverse. Answering Your Honor's question, at the time Jane Hornung filed her petition for instructions, the assets of Robert's Trust had already been transferred, and in fact, its transferee had already transferred those assets again. And I hope the court took note of briefing we had that there was some strategy on the part of Appley Hornung, clearly, in that there was terms in Betty's trust that said if Ms. Hornung were to sue the trust, sue the beneficiaries, that the transfer of certain land that was to go to Jane's children should not occur, and in fact, those assets should be used to defend litigation. This petition that is on review, that was tried, was filed within days after Betty's trust completed transfer of that real estate to her children. The county court's authority to grant equitable relief in this proceeding and order Roger to recover the trust assets already transferred required a finding. Roger committed an actionable breach of trust. As this court has stated repeatedly, county courts can acquire jurisdiction only through legislative enactment. County courts are without equity jurisdiction. They may apply equitable principles in probate and trust jurisdiction matters. However, that power is limited. As this court has stated, for example, a county court does not have equity jurisdiction to impose a constructive trust, recover assets on that theory on behalf of a personal representative or a trustee.
Suppose we agree with all of that. Where does that take us? What do we end up doing?
The transfers are effective. They filed a petition for instructions. They didn't ask for a judgment for anyone. They didn't ask, Ms. Hornung didn't ask for a reversal. I asked the court to reverse any transfers, although they are arguing now that it was somehow implied, which is a jurisdictional issue. The end result simply is I find the court, the county court, found that Roger did not commit a breach of trust, therefore his acts are valid. So regardless of what legal analysis you can apply as to whether or not the exercise of the power appointment was effective, his transfers are effective because the county court has, once transferred, has no ability to undo that. And that goes in large part to what I just said is, this is part procedure and strategy on Ms. Hornung's part. If the assets were still in Robert's trust, then you wouldn't need that. It would simply be instructions of, hey, wait a minute, we've heard that Roger is about to transfer assets according to the exercise. We think that's wrong. Well, there wouldn't need to be that. But they waited until there was a transfer and then a transfer of that. There simply is, the result is a validation of those transfers.
Counsel, what's the impact of Section 30-3814 and that the subject matter jurisdiction conferred by that statute to county courts on your argument?
Right. As we briefed, Your Honor, you can't, first of all, this court has already rejected the application, the broad application that Ms. Hornung argues in Washington v. Conley, It would make a lot of statutes, including 3890, which provides for certain powers of the county court, certain equitable powers, if they find a breach of trust. It would make those superfluous. And what this court aptly said in Washington v. Conley is, those apply to situations regarding an express trust. It doesn't grant the court, doesn't grant the county court, contrary to a plethora of case law from this court, power to impose a constructive trust or act in regards to a constructive trust. It would only regard express trust
actions. What's your best argument that a constructive trust was imposed here as a remedy?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Please say that again.
You're talking about constructive trusts. Are you suggesting that the remedy here was at the imposition of a constructive trust of some sort?
I have to assume that. The court didn't rule that. The court just simply said, Roger, go get these assets that have not only been transferred, but they're transferred again. As I brief, I have to assume, I assume that implicitly the court is trying to impose some sort of constructive trust, which it would have no authority to do. Ms. Hornung has said, well, no, the impliedly the court invalidated all the transfers, which, of course, we briefed and said, well, now, if you go to that extent, there certainly wasn't service on the transferees, service of summons. There wasn't any pleading, any request for that relief.
Counselor, excuse me for interrupting, but if the appointments were deemed invalid, wouldn't any transfers made pursuant to the appointment also be deemed invalid? Why not?
It would not, because the trustee acted in good faith, and these are already assets that are outside of the trust. It's already been completed.
Too late to fix it.
It's too late to undo those transfers, and certainly in the context, Your Honor, of the fact that we don't have those transferees here. What you're suggesting, Your Honor, respectfully, is that the court could, without anybody seeking a judgment, anybody seeking affirmatively to void specific transfers, that they get a notice in the mail after the fact and say, oh, by the way, you don't own that real estate. And that simply doesn't apply with due process, doesn't apply with the subject matter jurisdiction of the court. It's our position. I'm out of time, Your Honor. We request, if the court does not grant Sandra's relief, the court reverse the county court on the issue of ordering Roger to recover those assets. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Is there any time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. Our next case of the day is Stewart versus Heinemann.